So in this talk, again, we're going to veer off in a different direction from all the previous lectures. This one, I think, will be solely a talk kind of in the domain of complex numbers today. Tomorrow, I'll try to indicate some applications of what I have to say today to problems about heights, but this one will be maybe a little bit more down to earth. I'm going to start out by describing what I suppose might be said to be a trivial change in notation, hardly seems worthwhile doing at first, but one which suggests the possibility of looking at Mahler's measure in a very different way. So, of course, in virtually all the literature and all the talks in this conference and my own talks the last couple of times, Mahler's measure is something you do to a polynomial. And now I want to just make the trivial observation that Mahler's measure could also be something that you think of as doing to the vector of coefficients of the polynomial. So let's leave the polynomial aside and think of Mahler's measure as something you do to a vector. For today, that vector will be a vector of n plus 1 complex variables. And what do you do to it? Well, you take a vector, say, boldface x here, whose coordinates are x0, x1, and so forth. Those are complex numbers. And, well, you build this trigonometric expression, trigonometric polynomial. You take the log of the absolute value. You integrate around, in effect, the unit circle. Here, e of t, of course, as previously, is e to the 2 pi I t. And then you take the exponential function after that, and you've produced a new function, which I'll call mu of the vector x. And of course, we can all recognize that what's really happened here is that mu of the vector x is the Mahler measure of the polynomial whose coefficients are the coordinates x0, x1, x2 of the vector. Okay, so nothing too profound, one would think, could come out of this very simple change of language. And yet, I want to, I hope, convince you today that it does allow us to speak differently about Mahler's measure. New problems arise, and perhaps new techniques arise. What kind of a function is mu of x, might be the first thing to ask. Well, I've written down some elementary properties that are easy to verify, not properties phrased in terms of polynomials, but now properties phrased in terms of, well, functions on n plus 1 dimensional complex Euclidean space or Hermitian space. So the first one tells us that if I multiply the vector x by the complex scalar alpha, it's trivial to verify that the absolute value of alpha comes out in front. We would say that mu is sort of absolutely homogeneous, or sometimes the word symmetric is used in this context. Another observation which goes back to Mahler, it's not so easy to prove and will come up later in this talk in a more quantitative form, is the fact that the function which takes the vector x in n plus 1 variables to mu of x is continuous. Mahler proved that, and a few years ago, David Boyd gave a nicer, cleaner proof, which also applies to polynomials in several variables. And still later today, I'll describe a quantitative version of this result. The previous versions of continuity were produced essentially by compactness principles, so that given epsilon, you knew there exists a delta such that the inequalities that describe continuity occur. It raises the question, can you make it quantitative? Given epsilon, what delta will work so that the inequalities of continuity are correct? And we'll see that that has an application later on. Another property, trivial but still important from the point of view I'm going to take here, is that mu of the vector x is 0 if and only if x is 0. Now, if you're familiar with the geometry of numbers, say the classic text of Castle's Introduction to the Geometry of Numbers, or a slightly more recent book of Leka Kirkeker. Let's see, there's a second author too, Gruber, I guess. In any event, if you're familiar with the geometry of numbers, you might recognize that the first three conditions here are exactly the conditions for mu to be what's called a distance function. In some contexts, it's called a gauge function. And, well, in the geometry of numbers, one is interested in sets defined by gauge functions or distance functions. And a basic question is, are there conditions on the gauge function or on the set Sn plus 1, which you can think of as kind of the unit ball of the gauge function or distance function. I use ball sort of loosely. It would be more precise, as I've indicated here, to call it what it usually is in the context of the geometry of numbers, a star body. Anyway, a basic problem in the geometry of numbers is, given a star body subject to perhaps other conditions, under what circumstances can you conclude that the star body contains a lattice point other than the zero lattice point usually, which is trivially in the star body? Minkowski's convex body theorem is a result of this sort. Of course, it applies much more specially when the distance function satisfies the triangle inequality, and so the star body described here as Sn plus 1 is actually a convex body in that case. In the situation that's evolving here, the set Sn plus 1 is highly non-convex. Star body is a good name for it. If you stand at the origin of Cn plus 1 and you look at a ray going off to infinity and you were to walk along that ray, you would experience being inside this star body until you came to a boundary point, and then you would leave the star body, and ever after you would be outside the star body. To get sort of a handle on it, you might think along the following lines. Let's take, say, the polynomial x minus 1 to a large power, such as capital N. That has Mahler measure 1, and so the vector that you get by looking at the polynomial, that vector would have binomial coefficients, right? X minus 1 to the n as its coefficients. So from our point of view, that's a somewhat large vector. It's far from the origin in the Euclidean sense because, well, the coefficients are binomial coefficients and they're pretty big. On the other hand, that's on the surface of the star body, right? The star body I'm referring to here is Sn plus 1, because the Mahler measure of that vector with big binomial coefficients in it is 1. Say, for example, when n is 10, that would be true. On the other hand, if we take the Lehmer polynomial, then the coefficients are plus minus 1s and zeros, and so that's rather closer to the origin. If we stand at the origin, we see the vector corresponding to the Lehmer polynomial rather closer to us. On the other hand, it's above the surface of the star body. So although in the Euclidean sense it's in close, the star body must somehow have arms that go way out and capture these cyclotomic things, which could conceivably have big coefficients, and then it comes back in and works its way around things like the Lehmer polynomial or other polynomials, which have Mahler measure bigger than 1, but still have small coefficients. So this sort of tells us that Sn plus 1, while it's a bounded symmetric star body in the sense of the geometry of numbers, the definition of a bounded symmetric star body is essentially a set produced by this, where the function mu satisfies 1, 2, and 3. Although it's a reasonable set produced by a continuous homogeneous function, we know that the shape is rather complicated. And if n is large, one expects to have a large number of arms, a sort of starfish-shaped thing, but with a very large number of arms that go out and capture certain polynomials with large coefficients with small Mahler measure. Okay, I should add one other curious thing here. Mahler, of course, worked a great deal in the geometry of numbers. Mahler's compactness theorem is still a fundamental result in this field. Mahler certainly worked with general distance functions, as described here, and Mahler proved theorems about star bodies. To the best of my knowledge, Mahler never worked with this particular distance function and this particular star body, although he might have. He certainly worked with Mahler measure. He certainly worked with what's happening here. But for some reason, the two notions were not blended in his work. And as far as I know, the first instance in which this point of view is taken is in the results I'm going to describe here. Now, it turns out that it's also a good idea, based on the techniques that are going to evolve, to restrict attention in a slightly novel way, but a simple way, to a function I'm calling the monic Mahler measure. So this is easily explained. We just cut the vector down to n complex variables, calling it y now, and then we make the polynomial, which is monic and has the coordinates y1, y2, yn as coefficients. So we have this simple formula here. And actually, for my purposes, nu will be the more fundamental function. It's easy to go between nu and mu because the recipe for changing the leading coefficient on a polynomial and then computing its Mahler measure is so simple. Right? So it's easy to go back and forth between the two. And then by the Jensen formula, obviously if we know what the roots of this polynomial are, then we know what the monic Mahler measure is as a function of the roots. But my point of view, at least initially, will be to set the polynomial aside and ask what can we learn about this function viewed as a function on the vector of coefficients. So viewed as a function on now cn plus 1 in the case of mu, or cn in the case of the monic Mahler measure nu. Well, here are some simple things that we can start with. Here, norm x means the Hermitian or L2 norm of x, which I think has occurred before. And this is a very well-known inequality about the Mahler measure mu, but now reformulated as an inequality about functions on the vector x. Then you instantly get this version of the inequality here in y. There the monic Mahler measure is estimated. And now it's a simple matter to use this inequality to draw the conclusion that this integral, where now we're integrating over Rn in the first case and integrating over Cn in the second case, it's easy to use this estimate to discover that if you think of sigma here as a positive real parameter, then that integral will converge if and only if sigma is greater than capital N. Okay? So there's nothing deep or difficult of this. It's just the observation that this inequality tells us that nu of y is, roughly speaking, comparable with this expression here, 1 plus y squared to the 1/2, where we're taking the Euclidean norm of y. And if you use, for example, polar coordinates, you can easily do the estimate. So why would we do that? Well, if you're an analytic number theorist by training, sigma is, of course, something that you think of as the real part of the complex variable s plus s equals sigma plus it. And so you could now try to make a kind of fancy-looking object. Let's define a function of the complex variable s. I'm going to call that function capital F sub n of s. There's a parallel function, s to capital G sub n of s. By replacing the real parameter sigma here by the complex variable s. And now, since we know from these lines that these integrals are absolutely convergent in the half-plane real part of s, sigma, bigger than capital N, we can draw the conclusion that the functions defined here, capital F sub N and capital G sub N, are analytic functions in the half-plane real part of s greater than N. If you're familiar with the basic theory of the Riemann zeta function or the analytic proof of the prime number theorem, you might recognize that things that are beginning to occur are at least reminiscent of that theory. Indeed, these integrals are examples of Mellin transforms. That, from an analytic point of view, is insignificantly different than the Fourier transform. Usually, in this context, the Fourier transform is presented on the additive group of real numbers or Euclidean space. Here, it's the multiplicative group of positive real numbers that's coming into play when it's called the Mellin transform. But the two theories are essentially the same. Now, we can continue this theme of trying to make objects which are reminiscent of the tools of analytic number theory by introducing a distribution function. So that's coming next here. Little f sub n of the positive real variable xi is going to be the Lebesgue measure, lambda sub n, n-dimensional Lebesgue measure, of the set of vectors y in Rn, where the monic Mahler measure, so the monic Mahler measure of a certain polynomial, but the polynomial is now to be banished from our language for a few minutes, where the monic Mahler measure is less than or equal to xi. Of course, this isn't a probability distribution function because the total measure is not 1, but it analytically works the same way. And then little g sub n of xi is the exactly analogous object in which we work not over Rn, but over Cn. All right, now, from the basic definition of the integral, it's an easy matter, kind of a standard matter, really, to write fn of s not as an integral in which you're integrating y over Rn and then taking nu to a power, but you take a real positive variable xi to that same power, and then the measure induced by the distribution function here, if you think of this as a Stieltjes integral, for example, the measure induced by the distribution function keeps track of, roughly speaking, the proportion of time that xi takes on a particular value. And when you integrate by parts, you get something that looks even more reminiscent of the formulas that occur in classical prime number theory. Here I'm thinking of formulas that would occur if you study, say, the analytic proof of the prime number theorem. An exact duplicate formula occurs with respect to capital G and the distribution function little g. Okay, now at this stage we have a formula which at least makes it possible that we might understand these distributions functions little f and little g. Perhaps one even could imagine a formula for little f and little g by inverting this integral transform formula. And indeed that can be done. Again, if you're familiar with the proof of the prime number theorem, you know that the integral that inverts this, sometimes called Perron's formula, involves a contour integral of the function gn of s on a vertical line in the complex plane. And initially, that vertical line will be a line whose real part must be larger than capital N, for the obvious reason that the function capital Fn and capital Gn are only known to us at this stage to be analytic in the half-plane real part of S greater than capital N. Okay. Now, at this stage, however, we should be sobered by the following observation. I know of no reason, no heuristic reason, no even bad heuristic reason ever suggested, as to why Fn and Gn should be simple knowable functions. When I first encountered this sort of thing, my first reaction was, well, you know, nu of y, how do you produce that? You take exp of integral of log of absolute value, you integrate the whole thing. Why should we be able to know that function? Maybe that's just itself. It's not related to any classical functions. And if that's the case, when you create this Mellin transform, okay, analytic in real part of s greater than capital N, you can get that just by working back to this simple inequality here, nothing profound about that. Why should capital Fn and capital Gn be related to any other known functions? Why aren't they just themselves, right? Just some new special functions, perhaps, but that's sort of the end of it. Well, it turns out that my instinct on this was totally wrong. In work with a former student of mine, C.J. Chern, we discovered, much to my surprise, that Fn and Gn extend by analytic continuation to rational functions on the complex plane with rational coefficients. And in fact, we can know them completely. There are no mysteries about them at all. I still don't know why really this occurs. I know why it occurs in the sense that you can work through the very lengthy proof of this and discover it, but I don't know any principle that I could explain today which might convince you that Fn and Gn will surely extend, say, to a meromorphic function on the complex plane, and then you have to work out where the poles and zeros are. The only way I know to achieve it is actually to figure out exactly what Fn and Gn are. Notice that Fn and Gn both have poles at integers. The zero occurs here to a large multiplicity power. The zero s to the n occurs there to a large multiplicity power. And there's a constant that occurs, which is important. The constant in the case of Fn, where you're integrating over Rn, that constant is quite complicated in a certain sense. And the fact that it's complicated is felt in the proof. But anyway, in the end, we find, much to my surprise, that Fn and Gn extend by analytic continuation to rational functions on S. I think one possible interpretation of this might parallel what David was speaking of yesterday in his talk. I think it's fair to say, although it's getting to be better and better known territory, that it must come as something of a surprise that when you integrate the log absolute value of a polynomial in, say, two variables or three variables with integer coefficients, that this turns out to be a number that's related to known numbers, or somewhat known numbers. It seems that it might have just been some independent transcendental number, algebraically independent of all numbers that we know. There is no a priori reason to expect it to be something that we can evaluate in terms of other things. Thus, Mahler's measure contains sort of a surprise. It doesn't look tractable, but it turns out when you get into it that it's much more tractable than you might have expected. And this seems to be, and this is only the first example I will describe, this seems to be an instance of something like that. It's a bit of a surprise to me that the Mellin transform of the distribution of values function for Mahler's measure, both in the real case and the complex case, turns out to be, well, something we can know, something actually quite simple, something that involves integer coefficients even. The poles are at integers, the zeros are at integers, all the residues are rational numbers. It's the curious occurrence of arithmetic in the study of Mahler's measure where you don't necessarily have any reason to expect it, but it occurs anyway, happily. Now, what can you do with this sort of thing? Well, here's what you can do. You can learn exactly what the distribution functions Fn and Gn are by Mellin inversion. If you want, you could say it this way. You can use the Mellin inversion formula, or sometimes called Perron's formula, to write little fn as a contour integral in which there is a vertical line in the right half plane, as you do in proving the prime number theorem. And now, armed with analytic continuation, you can move that vertical line to the left, collect the residues from the singularities. That couldn't be an easier task because, look, the singularities all occur at integer points. The residues are all perfectly computable, rational numbers. And, well, when you move the line of integration to the left, out pops a formula involving the residues, and you can just collect the terms, and here you have an explicit formula for the distribution function fn of xi. Here is a similar formula for the distribution function gn of xi. Remember, fn keeps track of the measure of the set where the monic Mahler measure on Rn is large. Gn keeps track of the measure of the set of points in Cn where the monic Mahler measure is large. You'll notice that the distribution functions turn out to be polynomials. By the way, it's trivial that if the parameter xi is less than 1, then the distribution function must be identically 0 there, right? Because there are no vectors whose monic Mahler measure is less than 1, because the vector produces a monic polynomial, and of course the Mahler measure has to be at least 1. All right, so these formulas only apply when the parameter xi is greater than or equal to 1. So what we... there is a parallel situation that comes to mind as you ask that question. In the explicit formulas for the psi function that occur in analytic number theory, there is an interpretation when the parameter is between 0 and 1. I think there is not, unfortunately, that I know of in this case, because the truth is simply that fn of xi is definitely 0 when xi is 0 and 1 for the trivial reason that you can't make a monic polynomial have Mahler measure less than 1. On the other hand, this polynomial certainly makes sense when xi is less than 1, and so it's a valid question to say, okay, how do you interpret it? I guess the answer maybe is I just don't know how to interpret it there, or what its significance is, if any. Anyway, you see now that while over on this transparency, I tried to behave as though this was all going to be very mysterious, because once upon a time it was mysterious to me. I have no reason to believe, from what I've said at this point, that fn of xi is a simple function, knowable by us. I mean, it's obviously an increasing function, but there are a lot of increasing functions that can't necessarily be described by the special functions that humanity has assembled up until this date. It could just be new on its own, so to speak. But it turns out quite the opposite is true. It's a polynomial in xi. And not only that, but its coefficients are rational numbers. Right? And same remark for g. Now, the proof of this theorem splits into two pieces. First, you can attack the real case, and then when you survive that experience, you can attack the complex case. I would say that the real case is, and I mean this quite seriously, more difficult by a factor of 100. The complex case I will do here on just a couple transparencies. In the published version, the real case took about 30 to 35 pages, I think. And I don't believe that's, in a sense, the way the proof should be. But that's the only proof I know today, is to actually work out all the details. I can say maybe a little bit at this point, and we'll say more later, about why the real case is so much more difficult than the complex case. And it has to do with the fact that if you have a polynomial with real coefficients, you seem to need to chop up Euclidean space into subregions depending on the number of complex zeros versus the number of real zeros. And then you make a further chopping up of space depending on whether the complex zeros are outside the unit circle or inside the unit circle, whether the real zeros are outside the interval minus 1, 1 or inside, because of course the Mahler measure changes under those circumstances. Well, that means the problem expands into many, many subproblems that have to be done somewhat individually, unfortunately. There's a change of variables that occurs, and the Jacobian is different depending on the subregions. And so today, I only know how to proceed in a rather complicated, somewhat indirect, combinatorially formidable way. But eventually, and I really have to say very much thanks to Sejay Chern, more about the history later, it can be pushed through. The complex case is rather simpler. Here is just the proof in the complex case, or at least an outline of the proof. All right, so I'm going to describe the proof of this formula 3.2, which of course corresponds to the evaluation of, right up here, of this integral, evaluation and analytic continuation to the left half plane. So the first thing we need to do is make a giant change of variables. Initially, we are integrating over Cn, so we are initially integrating the coefficients of the polynomial. But what I'd like to do is make a change of variables so that I can integrate the roots of the polynomial. For obvious reasons, Mahler's measure is a certain product over the roots. A multiple integral of products can split up into a product of integrals, and that's what happens, basically. So in order to make this change of variables, I need to introduce the elementary symmetric polynomials. So those are the ENs. And of course, they are defined by this familiar-looking formula. And now let's use the elementary symmetric polynomials to define a map, which I'm calling capital E sub N. This map is a polynomial map, and it sends n complex variables to n complex variables. You take a vector alpha with n complex variables, and you list the elementary symmetric polynomials, and that's En of alpha. Okay, and that's a map from n complex variables to n complex variables. Now, by the very definition of the monic Mahler measure, you see that we have this second line here. The monic Mahler measure of En of alpha, well, En of alpha produces the vector, which is the vector of coefficients of a polynomial whose roots are alpha 1, alpha 2, and so forth. And of course, the monic Mahler measure by the Jensen formula is just the product of max 1 and the roots. The raising to the power 2s, s a complex variable whose real part is bigger than capital N, comes along, and that's what you get. All right, now, instead of integrating over the coefficients, I wish to integrate over the roots, alpha, because I would much rather work with the right-hand side than the left-hand side. The left-hand side is, so to speak, what occurs in the original definition of Gn. The right-hand side is a more valuable thing to work with because being a product and having a multiple integral, this is going to split up and simplify. There is one little difficulty, however, that must be overcome. This polynomial map has a Jacobian, and that has to be determined. Fortunately, the Jacobian is tractable. It's essentially the absolute value of the van der Monde determinant, or you might remember when working with complex changes of variables, you use the absolute value squared of the determinant. In the real case, you don't get to square, right? When you make a map from Rn to Rn, the Jacobian is the determinant of a certain Jacobian matrix, I guess it's usually called, and then you have to take the absolute value of that. But if you go from Cn to Cn, the Jacobian is the absolute value squared of the determinant. The squaring is a terrific advantage. It's exactly the same advantage as you have when you're trying to evaluate the integral of the square of a trigonometric expression, Parseval's formula, versus the integral of the absolute value of the trigonometric expression, L1 norm. Formidable, sometimes very difficult. And that's the difficulty that will occur when you do the real case. It seems a minor point, but it really is the source of a great deal of difficulty. Okay, so now what happens? Well, we make now the change of variables. Here's our original function, g sub n of s, the Mellin transform of the monic Mahler measure. S now a complex variable with, of course, still real part bigger than capital N. And I need to also account for the fact that a particular polynomial y can actually occur n factorial different times when I make this change of variables. This is not a bijection from Cn to Cn, right? Because I can permute the alphas, and since the elementary symmetric functions are symmetric, I get the same polynomial. So actually, this is a map which takes Cn to Cn, but each point over here in the range is covered n factorial times. I compensate for that by dividing by n factorial here. Okay? So now I have a new integral in which the alphas are the variables, and they run over all the possible n complex variables. And now the monic Mahler measure to the minus 2s power has been replaced by this expression to the minus 2s power. This is much better, but I also have this Jacobian I have to deal with. Okay? So that's the state of affairs so far. Now, how do I continue to make progress here? Well, the answer is, briefly, that each complex integral will be evaluated by changing to polar coordinates. So I take the alpha and I write it as Rn e to the theta n, where Rn is positive. Theta n, of course, runs between 0 and 1. I make all those changes of variables and sort of hope for the best here. Okay, well, here's what happens. When I look at the Jacobian, that van der Monde matrix, and write that as a sum where tau is a permutation and Sn is the symmetric group, it is a determinant and hence a sum over the symmetric group. Okay, I find this expression. This is somewhat, I think I haven't described this entirely accurately here, but this has had some simplifications also done to it. And when I go then to change to polar coordinates, it comes out in this fashion with respect to the radius Rn and the argument theta of n, okay, where Sn is still the symmetric group. All right, now, when I do all the integrals over the thetas, right, theta 1 through theta n, I'm confronted with this expression. So what happened to the max business? Well, nothing. You see, the thetas disappear there when I replace alpha n by Rn e to the I theta n. The e to the I theta n disappears inside the absolute value sign. So this expression is waiting to be integrated later with respect to the radii, R1, R2, and so on. But before getting there, I will just integrate out the thetas, and a happy thing occurs. This is a trigonometric polynomial, and so I can apply Parseval's formula because I'm integrating the Jacobian squared. Okay? Notice, if that 2 were not there, I'd be stuck. I'd have to do something, and the something would definitely be difficult. Not necessarily impossible, but difficult. Parseval's formula, of course, is one of the first principles here that one would try to invoke. And anyway, you then get this simple type of expression. Okay, well, now, having this at hand, I can go to the function gn of s. I can write down that integral. I can change to polar coordinates. When I do change to polar coordinates, I get this theta integration. I already know how the theta integration works and have recorded it there. And so my next line here involves the max expression. And then it also involves this thing. Now, notice there's a minus 2 here, but there's only a minus 1 there. Well, of course, that comes from the calculus observation that when you make a change to polar coordinates, dx dy becomes r dr d theta. And the extra r cancels one of the r to the minus 2s and produces an r to the, yeah, there it is, r to the minus 1. Okay, now it's a simple matter because here I have n integrals, but the very thing I'm integrating is a product of functions, and each term involves only one of the variables. So that's a happy situation. The integral of the product becomes a product of integrals. And each individual integral is now elementary and turns out to be a rational function of S. The permutation tau of n occurs, but, well, multiplication is commutative, so it doesn't really matter what tau of n I choose. And in the final analysis, we come down to this expression, which is, of course, I think surprisingly simple, right? A rational function poles at the integers from 1 to capital N, a high order 0 at 0, and some tractable coefficients. In the complex case, of course, it's not rational coefficients anymore because of the presence of the power of pi. Okay, so that in two transparencies is the complex case. The real case, as I say, is more difficult, and maybe a technical explanation for the difficulty is that the Jacobian appears to the first power, and so you have to chop up space depending on whether the Jacobian in the real case is positive or negative, for example, because you're going to be working with the absolute value of that Jacobian. And also, I should mention the other formidable aspect is that the Jacobian changes, not discontinuously, but non-differentiably, in regions of the space where roots are passing from outside the unit circle to inside the unit circle. Right? The nature of things. Now, what can you do with this? Well, the problem which motivated this study in the first place is the following. Is it possible to estimate the number of polynomials which have integer coefficients, degree less than or equal to n? Think of n as fixed here for the moment. Is it possible to estimate the number of polynomials with integer coefficients, degree less than or equal to n, and Mahler measure less than some large parameter xi, say? Well, since the Mahler measure, that's the mu function now, is homogeneous, this is essentially asking how many integer lattice points occur in a homogeneously expanding domain. By an obvious principle, the number of lattice points in this homogeneously expanding domain is approximately the volume of the domain. And as it is homogeneously expanding, its volume is the radius to the right power times the volume of the unit ball, the volume of the star body. So in other words, when you're trying to estimate the number of polynomials with integer coefficients, degree less than or equal to n, Mahler measure less than or equal to some large parameter as that large parameter goes to infinity, the main term should be given to you by the volume of this star body. So what's the volume of the star body? That was the problem that Chern originally tried to solve. I tried to be discouraging, but fortunately, he didn't trust me. My first intuition about this was quite wrong. I could see no reason why the volume would ever be known to us as a simple number. It seemed to me that one would refer forever to the volume of the star body, and that would be a certain number that could be approximated, like, say, Euler's constant, but it was just itself. It's x of integral of log, and so why should that be simple? It thus came as a very great surprise to me when Chern discovered by hand that in dimensions 2 through 7, which he worked out sort of directly, the volume of the star body is a rational number. And at that point, I became convinced that this must be generally so. And the method by which this was discovered was, roughly speaking, one in which these integrals that I'm describing here occurred, but the complex variable s was just replaced by the integer n plus 1. And the reason for that is, I think, explained to some extent by this corollary. So this is a corollary to the theorem I just proved. I just proved the complex version. And in this corollary, we have here a formula for each positive integer n, which provides us with the volume, or in other words, the Lebesgue measure, of the set of vectors x in Rn plus 1, where the Mahler measure is less than or equal to 1, the volume of the star body. And the second formula provides the analogous piece of information in the case of the complex star body. And the proof here is quite simple. You write the measure of this set using Fubini's theorem as, well, the integral of the characteristic function of the set. But then you split that integral up into an integral over R and an integral over Rn. And the integral over Rn, you just write out the definition of it, and of course that's the lower dimensional Lebesgue measure of this set. Then you make a change of variables in which the parameter u is removed. Remember, you have mu being homogeneous so that you can factor out the u and you'll get a u inverse next to the y. Also, instead of integrating over R, I've doubled the integral and integrated from 0 to infinity, sort of a trivial point. And then I've made a change of variables here. You can try this yourself. And discovered that the integral could also be written in terms of a new variable xi. And in the new variable xi, the measure of the set of points y where the, now this is the monic Mahler measure, is less than or equal to u inverse makes an appearance. U inverse is now the new variable xi. And that's just the distribution function. Great. Well, when I integrate this, I get the value of fn. You probably have them quicker than I do. Right, here's a formula which gives an integral of xi to the minus complex variable s minus 1 of fn of xi. Well, isn't that the same thing, essentially? It's occurring right here, except that the complex variable s has been, I believe, replaced by n plus 1. And some adjustment has to be made in front of the integral of a trivial nature. So that this integral is actually a special value of the fn of s function. Well, it's a special value at n plus 1. Now, in Chern's original work on this, he had essentially produced these types of integral formulas, but there was no complex variable s, no discussion of analyticity, no discussion of analytic continuation. He just directly was interested in figuring out the volume of the star body. And so this expression appeared. I think he worked on this without talking to me for several months and then appeared at my door one day with a big sheaf of papers and announced that he had figured out the volume for dimensions 2 through 7, and in spite of my skepticism that there was anything to learn, it turned out to be rational. And I took these papers home with me and studied them, roughly speaking, for one summer to figure out how in the world he'd accomplished this. And after a great deal of trial and error and reformulation and recomplication and so forth, began to realize that everything he had done in low dimensions could be done with the n here replaced by a complex variable. Hence, we started all over again and said, let's look at the Mellin transform. No, that was not. I mean, that it's presented here as if we had the great idea of looking at Mellin transforms because we were somehow lucky enough to find the volume. But of course, historically, it didn't happen that way at all. Chern was interested in the volume. I was rather skeptical that it could be identified as a simple number. In fact, in low dimensions, he identified it as a rational number. And then when I took a look at the method, I realized that the n could be replaced by a complex variable, so that this really turns out to be the special value of a Mellin transform. Okay, so you can, of course, behave in a similar manner in the complex case, and you will get this formula, so that the volume in the complex case turns out to be the special value of the Gn rational function. And, of course, now the reason is explained, at a certain level at least, for why the volume of the star body turned out to be a rational number, as a matter of fact, it's a rational function with rational coefficients evaluated a rational number. So of course, it's rational. And in the complex case, the same words apply except for the extra factors of pi. Okay, now, what more can one do with this? Well, remember I said that the, so to speak, original motivating problem was one of estimating the number of polynomials with integer coefficients, or in this language, the number of lattice points, where the degree of the polynomial is less than or equal to n, and the Mahler measure is less than some large parameter t. Okay, and we are now in a position to make such estimates because, well, for example, we've captured the volume of the star body, and we've also captured the distribution function associated with the monic Mahler measure. And by the way, I said at the very beginning of the talk that we're going to have sort of a change of point of view, and I think now I hope that that remark is a little clearer. When first thinking about Mahler's measure as something you do to a polynomial, for me at least, it doesn't suggest that volume is something that's going to come into play, right? There's no geometrical language suggested, at least not immediately. But when you think of it as something you do to a vector, then possibly the volume of some regions or other geometrical facts arise. And indeed, that continues to be the case here. So now, let me describe, without any further proofs, some further results that can be obtained in this direction. Let us define script M of n capital T to be the function that I've spoken about here. The number of polynomials having integer coefficients, degree at most capital N, and Mahler measure less than or equal to the parameter capital T. And then M sub 1 is the related quantity in which we are speaking of the number of monic polynomials with integer coefficients. Essentially, we can get our hands on approximations or estimates for both of these objects. And a first remark here would be that, of course, the value of script m of nt, the number of integer lattice points in the dilated star body, dilated by the amount capital T, would be approximately the volume of the star body, right, by sort of a basic principle. And the volume of the star body, then, by homogeneity, is just the volume of the star body itself. I should say the volume of T, the dilated star body, is the volume of the star body itself times, in dimension n plus 1, it would be T to the power n plus 1. So we should expect that script M is approximately this. And while the volume of the star body might have been just a sort of constant, depending on capital N, that might be numerically approximated, it turns out, from what I've described so far, that this volume, which I'm now abbreviating as V sub n plus 1, is this rational number. Complicated, yes, but rational number, and totally known to us. All right, now, when you're trying to show that the number of integer lattice points inside of a large, roughly speaking, roundish sort of body is, roughly speaking, the volume of the body, the error term that you make, the error that you make in this approximation begins to arise. And it turns out, from fairly general principles, that that error term is related to, and in ideal cases or favorable cases, it's roughly speaking proportional to the surface area of the body. Well, that principle can be applied as long as you can show that the surface area is technically called a rectifiable surface. And indeed, in this case, it can be shown to be rectifiable. We can say a little bit more, and it's sort of interesting to do so. Here I have worked out the equations which define the surface of the star body in the real case and in the case where n plus 1 is equal to 4. So this is the case that would occur for cubic polynomials because a cubic polynomial has 4 coefficients. Okay, and you see, Mahler's measure surprises us yet again. The surface of the star body is described by polynomials, and the polynomials have integer coefficients. Again, if you go back to the beginning and look at the definition of Mahler measure, x, integral, log, and so forth, I can't see any simple reason why the set of points where that function takes the value 1 should be a surface whose pieces, so to speak, are the zero set of polynomials with integer coefficients. Well, I mean, I can explain it because it's true and I know how to prove it, but it's not simple. It's not obvious. Maybe that's the way to say it. Right? It's again, another one of these instances where arithmetic arises somewhat unexpectedly in the study of Mahler measure. Okay, so here I've recorded the polynomials which happen to occur in the case n plus 1 equal 4, and one can work out more general formulas for higher n, though they get a little bit complicated. Well, so using the basic principle then that the number of lattice points in one of these star bodies is roughly the volume, we come upon the following theorem. So for each positive integer n, here is a estimate in the language of classical analytic number theory, the number of polynomials, degree less than or equal to n, integer coefficients, Mahler measure less than or equal to t, is given by a certain rational constant, Vn plus 1. We know it's the volume of a certain region. It's been determined. The main term is t to the n plus 1, and the error term is big O of t to the n. The big O depends on the surface area of the star body. It can be made somewhat precise. The dependence can be made somewhat precise. Before going further, let me mention two problems here, because we're kind of coming to the edge of my knowledge about this. A good problem is to try to determine the surface area, technically called Hausdorff measure, n-dimensional Hausdorff measure, of the star body Sn plus 1. So simply put, what is the surface area of this star body whose volume turns out to be a rational number? Of course, once upon a time I would have said, well, it's probably some number we won't ever know, but having discovered how wrong that is, the volume is certainly knowable, I'm of the opinion that perhaps the surface area is also a tractable expression. A somewhat related problem, I've called it problem G, problem A, B, C, and so forth, were on, I think, on the transparencies last Thursday, so I'm kind of going through the alphabet here in my list of problems. A somewhat related problem here, problem G, if capital T is some large integer lattice points, it would be interesting to know how many lattice points actually occur on the dilated star body of radius capital T. Both in the Mahler measure case, as I've described first, and then also estimate the number of integer lattice points in the monic Mahler measure case. So this is essentially the question, given a large real number capital T, how many distinct, the distinction might be trivial, but how many distinct polynomials with integer coefficients are there that can take that value as its Mahler measure? Of course, usually zero, but how big could that get, for example? Or another way of saying it would be, on the surface of the star body of radius capital T, what's the maximum number of lattice points that can occur on that thing? Right? So this is somewhat like the Gauss circle problem, right? How many lattice points can occur on a circle? Well, there are arithmetic formulas for it and so forth, and it's somewhat connected to the error term in the circle problem. Now, the big O, as I say, depends on n, obviously, and on the surface area. And I don't really have any news to report in general about an estimate for that implied constant. But it would be interesting to do that, and I can say more, and will say more here about it, because, well, in applications of things such as 8.1, one might find that you're really interested in measuring the number of polynomials with, so to speak, small Mahler measure as t grows, but also as n grows. Right? It could happen. And so it would be of interest to be a little bit more specific about this error that occurs here, and to be able to keep track of things as t grows and also as n grows. As it's stated here, no information is available to you from that theorem as n grows, because it's just some constant that depends on n, and nothing is stated to control the growth of that. So Chern and I sort of pushed ahead with that question and tried to develop a procedure for estimating the implied constant here. Now, the obvious way to do it is to estimate the surface area of the star body, and we were never really able to do that very satisfactorily. So instead, we hit upon a different method, which is maybe of some independent interest and involves the possibility that you can make the continuity of mu quantitative. And that led us to this curious theorem here, 8.2. So this, if you look at it closely, tells you that mu, the Mahler measure, viewed as a function on vectors, is a continuous function. But it gives it in a quantitative version. Given epsilon, here's a recipe for the delta that occur in the definition of continuity. So if x and y are vectors in Cn plus 1, then it turns out it's convenient to raise the Mahler measure mu of x to the fractional power 1 over capital N, and measure how close it is to the Mahler measure of y raised to that fractional power. And it turns out it's, well, pretty close if x and y aren't too far apart. And here is a precise inequality that gives that type of information, where it turned out to be convenient to use the L1 norm on vectors. You can untangle the 1 over n fractional exponent in this, but this actually turns out to be, I think, the cleanest way of writing it. Here's a good problem. I don't really know, no progress on this to report. Problem H, I've called it. And that's to extend this inequality, 8.2, to polynomials in several variables. So we know from Dave's paper of some years ago that the Mahler measure is continuous still, but can you make that statement quantitative? And ideally, I think, can you make it quantitative on polynomials in several variables so that when you specialize to one variable, you recapture this inequality? There's an application of this that I mentioned last Thursday. I think I briefly mentioned the notion of a Pinner polynomial and the fact that you can actually find the maximum Mahler measure on Pinner polynomials. That's proved by using this inequality. Well, actually, you use 95% of the proof of this inequality, and then the last 5% you have to make a little adjustment. But in principle, you're applying that inequality. Okay, well, here are two theorems which Chern and I obtained, which give more precise information about the estimate for script m of nt, and also the second theorem is the analogous fact about m sub 1. Remember, m sub 1 detects the number of monic Mahler measure, monic polynomials of degree now equal to capital N, and Mahler measure less than capital T. In the first theorem, the main term, of course, by my previous remarks, is the volume, a known constant, times t to the n plus 1. And the distance that script m is from that estimate is bounded by this explicit function. And that explicit function, or that estimate, applies and is non-trivial when t is rather large compared with capital N, I will admit. But the utility of this type of estimate, which is not as sharp as the one with the big O, in the case of the big O, I had t to the capital N. Right? Now I have t to the capital N, but then I have to add on a positive quantity, less than 1, fortunately, to that exponent. However, this has the feature that the big O is determined, in effect. So here, both t and capital N are allowed to go to infinity. T must be much larger than capital N, but that's sort of the nature of things here. And then I have an analogous inequality, 9.2, which is of the very same kind, a little bit more complicated to write out, the very same kind, and it involves the monic Mahler measure. But now the estimating function is no longer this simple monomial, but the estimating function is the distribution function, f sub n of t. So this tells us how far the M1 function is from the distribution function. Remember, the distribution function is the measure of a set, but M is the number of lattice points in that set. M1 is the number of lattice points in that set. And the constant Cn is the very same constant that occurred in front of the Fn function. By the way, I've mentioned here somewhat parenthetically a paper of David Boyd and Hugh Montgomery called Cyclotomic Partitions. And in that paper, they estimated, in my language, not in their language in the paper, but in this language, what they did was estimate the following. How many monic polynomials are there whose degree is less than n and whose molar measure is less than or equal to 1. Well, in other words, how many polynomials are there of degree less than or equal to n which are composed only of cyclotomic factors, hence the name cyclotomic partitions? And they gave an estimate for it. And that sort of, inspires my question here. Estimate these quantities not as t grows, but as n grows. That seems quite tough. It's no longer the case that your intuition should say the number of lattice points is roughly the volume of a certain region. It's just like estimate the number of lattice points in a sphere of radius 5 in dimension n as n grows. The volume of the sphere is not related to the number of lattice points in the region. Right? Indeed, if the sphere has, I think, radius 1.1 or something, the volume goes to 0, and the number of lattice points goes to infinity. This seems quite difficult to go in the opposite direction and let n get large and let t sort of stray way behind n, or maybe even t bounded. This, of course, is dangerously close to Lehmer's problem, right? Because I suppose I would personally suspect that if t is less than 1.76, roughly speaking, then the bound given by Boyd and Montgomery is the same. They had t equal 1, in effect. Because I don't expect to find any integer polynomials at all whose molar measure is less than the Lehmer polynomial, right? But for example, to get started, if you're interested in such thing, how about estimating the number of either monic or non-monic polynomials with integer coefficients, molar measure less than or equal to 2, and degree n less than or equal to n. And I would be interested in knowing what is the correct estimate as n goes to infinity. Just fix t at some small value. Interesting, so you have more than just cyclotomic polynomials coming in. And finally, for those who are amused by such things, I included down here at the bottom, what's the volume of the star body is a question I sometimes have been asked. And here is an estimate for the log of the volume that you can work out using the Euler-Maclaurin summation formula. And it's also related to the constant Cn, which appears in front of the formula for Fn. Okay, now I would like to move into the area of more speculation here. So what I've spoken about, at least in the real case, the complex case is analogous, is the fact that if we take the monic Mahler measure, nu of y, raise it to the power minus s, in other words, make this Mellin transform, then this integral defines an analytic function in this right half plane. All very nice. And surprisingly, but happily, fn of s has an analytic continuation to a rational function on the whole complex plane. The poles and the zeros are easily found, simple numbers. And so I think of this as a kind of continuous expression where really I would like to know the discrete analog of this object. So if we were to integrate x to the minus s dx, that's a simple thing, right? I think it's s over s minus 1. Anyway, it has a pole at 1 of order 1 and residue 1. Sort of reminds one of the zeta function. The zeta function is the discrete analog. Instead of integrating x to the minus s, you sum x to the minus s over the integers. What happens in this case? So let's suppose we made this function script f of capital N. It's produced... Ooh, I seem to have a typo. Sorry. That capital D should not be there. Okay, if you have the notes, remove the capital D. Small d, right? Even I can see that. All right, so it should be nu of L to the minus S only. All right, so this object is the discrete analog of the Mellin transform up at the top. A kind of zeta function-like object. In fact, if n is 2, it is related to the Riemann zeta function. Now, by basic principles here, the same principles that tell us the region of convergence of the integral, you can discover the regions of convergence of the sum, and it's just the same. It's this, once the little d is removed, the region of convergence here is the half-plane real part of S greater than capital N. I would like to formulate the following conjecture, that this function script F sub N, defined now by the analogous generalized Dirichlet series, extends by analytic continuation to a meromorphic function on the complex plane. I think the relationship between the Dirichlet series and the integral is analogous to the relationship between the Riemann zeta function and the integral x to the minus s, which is s over s minus 1, which is, in other words, the pole that the zeta function has. A slightly riskier but possibly correct conjecture would be that if you take script Fn, the Dirichlet series, and subtract off capital Fn, you've removed singularities. Maybe you've removed all the singularities. Maybe it's true that script Fn minus capital Fn is an entire function. That's the way the zeta function works, right? One pole at s equal 1, you remove that, and what's left over must be entire. And that's a little shakier. This object has many poles, right, at the integers when n is large. I don't know if that exactly describes the singularities of this. I know I can prove that it's the case that the difference between Fn and script Fn does extend by analytic continuation one unit to the left of the abscissa of convergence, real part of S equal capital N. That is, you get one extra band of analyticity when you subtract off Fn of S. That more or less comes from the fact that we have an estimate for the number of nu sub L's compared with the measure of nu sub Y. Now, why would you be interested in this besides the analogy with the zeta function? Well, here's an explanation. Fn of S captures information in a smooth fashion about the behavior of the Mahler measure. But F sub n of S does not detect lattice points. It does not detect points with integer coordinates. Instead, I had to get a fact about integer coordinates by arguing without the Malan transform, by arguing that the number of lattice points in a region is roughly the volume, modulo sort of big O of the surface area. But if I could deal with script Fn of S with the same success, then I could avoid that step. And also, more importantly, I think the Lehmer conjecture should be encoded into the behavior of script F sub n, because script F sub n is sensitive to exactly where the Mahler measure is evaluated at polynomials with integer coefficients. But capital F cannot sense those. It's just like integral x to the minus s dx does not sense prime numbers, obviously, but the zeta function does. So here are some problems then related to these remarks. The first one, does script F sub n satisfy some type of functional equation? The easiest way to make an analytic continuation of the zeta function or the other L functions that occur in analytic number theory is to establish a functional equation. You don't have to do it that way, but it sure makes life easy once you do. Is it possible that this Dirichlet series defined in this fashion, we know there's a lot of arithmetic that goes into this thing, is it possible that that satisfies a functional equation? If so, it's certainly a big step toward analytic continuation. In fact, I guess probably it's the whole step, although I don't exactly know what the functional equation is at this stage. Problem K is also somewhat speculative. Is there an analog of the Euler product formula for the zeta function in this context? Now, at first that seems a little crazy, but, well, here's a perhaps positive heuristic remark in its direction. The Mahler measure is multiplicative. Give me a polynomial and I can produce the Mahler measure of the polynomial by breaking it up into its irreducible factors and then producing the Mahler measure of each irreducible factor. Isn't that what I do in arithmetic? I take a large integer and I discover, so to speak, what it is, if that makes sense, by breaking it up into its prime factors. Or maybe I should say it this way. I evaluate a multiplicative function at a large integer by breaking the integer up into its prime factors, right? And that process is exactly what makes the Euler product formula for the zeta function work, so to speak. Now, there's one complication, at least one complication. In the case of the Monnik-Muller measure, when you take two polynomials, say of degree 5 and degree 7, and you multiply them together, you get a polynomial of larger degree, degree 12, right? And so the setting changes. We're not just working with polynomials in dimension n anymore, and polynomials in dimension m. We've got to include polynomials in dimension n plus m. So how do you do that exactly? Well, I think the answer to that is, roughly speaking, that any Euler product must use all the fn's, not just fn of s for a fixed value of n. It must somehow put together all the fn's. So I visualize it as being a product over irreducible polynomials, which when it unfolds because of unique factorization of polynomials into irreducible polynomials, produces not just one fn of s, but all the fn of s's in some fashion. I realize this is rather vague, but anyway. One final word on this. If you're familiar with the Birling generalized prime number theory, then you might, again, have a little positive hint that something like this might be true, because the Birling generalized prime number systems are exactly situations where one takes the ordinary prime integers, replaces them by some other collection of generators, looks at the semi-group they generate, formally makes an Euler product and produces a formal zeta function and proves theorems about it. The set of values taken on by the Monnik-Muller measure does form a system of Birling generalized integers. Unfortunately, it's way outside the axioms that Birling used to prove results about this subject, and so far outside the axioms that when you make the formal Euler product, it doesn't converge for any value of s. Yeah, so that's obviously not the right way to do it. But it somehow maybe suggests there's some other way to proceed. And then finally, problem L here. What analytic properties of the functions fn of these Dirichlet series? Let's assume for thinking about L that we have an analytic continuation into the left half plane. What analytic properties about these functions are equivalent to Lehmer's conjecture? You can answer that sort of trivially if you just live in the right half plane, just like you can write down, you know, formal expressions for prime counting functions using the zeta function in the right half plane, but they're not very useful because our knowledge there is not very good in some sense, or not good enough. It doesn't get to the heart of the matter. So I would rather prefer a discovery of analytic properties of these functions equivalent to Lehmer's conjecture, which involve the behavior of fn of s in the left half plane, even though I don't even yet know that it has an analytic continuation there. Because I think that's probably a route which is more likely to succeed in case this direction of research has any possible bearing on Lehmer's problem. Finally, I'm almost done here. I thought it might be amusing to at least report what happens when you take the Monnik-Muller measure and replace it by something very familiar. I mean, in a sense, you could take some other familiar distance function. What's the easiest one? The Euclidean norm, I suppose, right, on Euclidean space. That's a nice distance function. What if we do all this Mellin transform stuff with that, right? In a sense, that should come first, right? Because the Muller measure is a more complicated thing about which we know less. Well, let's try it. So suppose instead of the Muller measure, we just use the good old Euclidean norm on vectors in Rn plus 1. Then the monic Euclidean norm, what's that? Well, that's the one you get by just taking the first coefficient and declaring it's always going to be 1, and then the other guys are variables, and so I'm calling that eta of y. And there it is, right? Okay, well, it's a parallel theory. You can take eta of y, raise it to the power minus sigma. That's finite if and only if sigma is bigger than capital N. Hence, when you have S a complex variable, sigma plus IT, one learns readily that this Mellin transform of the eta function is analytic in the half plane, real part of S bigger than capital N. Well, but in this case, it's easy to work out what eta of y is, because of course eta y is vastly simpler from this point of view than the Monnik-Mollier measure. And what you get is the discovery that this Mellin transform is indeed going to extend by analytic continuation to a meromorphic function. It's amusing that the meromorphic function most naturally is described as this thing I'm calling capital G, not to be confused with capital G sub n on the previous transparencies. It turns out to be describable as capital G of S minus n divided by capital G of S. And why would you write it that way? Well, because capital G is the function pi to the minus S over 2 times the Euler gamma function at S over 2. And what is the significance of that object, if any? Well, that is exactly the gamma factor in the functional equation of the Riemann zeta function. A coincidence? Well, tomorrow I will try to explain this coincidence away. It's not a coincidence, really. But I offer this as evidence that this phenomenon of taking distance functions, making Mellin transforms, and expecting analytic continuation does also occur in what I think is the simplest case. And in the simplest case, the meromorphic function is not a mysterious thing. It's related, in fact, to the zeta function, as one might have guessed, I suppose, and I've sort of hinted at. Indeed, it turns out to be a ratio of functions which occur as the gamma factor in the functional equation. Okay, and so finally, last but not least here, I have a further problem. Suppose, now inspired by this, that we have some more general symmetric distance function, capital delta. And using capital delta, just as we did here using the Euclidean norm, we make the sort of monic object. By the way, I guess I even haven't said this. Why make the monic object? Why not just use the Mellin transform of the Euclidean norm? Answer, it doesn't converge for any complex value S. Right? No region of convergence. So you're stuck immediately. But when you make the monic object, well, something starts to happen. Okay, so problem M, if I have just a general symmetric distance function, and a little delta then is the corresponding monic distance function, what conditions on capital delta will imply that this Mellin transform does extend to a rational function or a meromorphic function for that matter on C? What's the general state of affairs? I've exhibited two examples. The Euclidean norm example, which produces a meromorphic function that I can identify, and the Mahler measure example, which produces, somewhat to my surprise, a rational function which can also be described. But surely this isn't the end of the list. There must be others. What exactly are the conditions on a distance function, which allows us to draw this conclusion? Okay, thank you.